Good afternoon. And Kathleen, I disagree. My position on sex work differs so sharply from that of Kathleen that I need to begin by defining my terms. By sex work, I mean the act of providing sexual services, a wide range of services, from phone sex to bondage, from stripping to prostitution, in exchange for money or other material consideration. My presentation is going to focus in on prostitution, though I'd be pleased to answer questions on any other form of sex work afterward. I use prostitution in particular because a defense of the most extreme form of sex work, I believe, constitutes a logical defense of any other lesser form of that work. In defining sex work, I use the word exchange to denote a voluntary interaction. I do not minimize, I do not deny for one second that many women around the world, including women in Virginia, are brutalized by men who force sex upon them by threats, rape, kidnapping, and other forms of assault. But when this happens, it is a case of rape, kidnapping, or assault, not of prostitution. And it should be punished as an act of violence, not of prostitution. To conflate prostitution and violence does nothing more than to stack the definition in such a manner as to preclude the possibility of any woman ever consenting to paid sex. I have spent years in and around what is known as the prostitutes' rights movement. Basically, this is a loose coalition of individuals and groups composed of mostly prostitutes and so-called pro-sex feminists, bound together by their advocacy of sex workers' rights at conferences, at group meetings of Coyote and other sex workers' organizations, through a survey of hundreds of women in the sex industry, and as a member of Hornet, an online dialogue between prostitutes and feminists, I have met literally hundreds of sex workers. By the way, whore is the preferred term among sex worker advocates for their profession. Most of the women I met were prostitutes who worked out-call or in-call rather than on the streets. Most women clearly stated that prostitution was a choice they made. Most of them didn't need money in the sense of being homeless or hungry. In fact, a considerable number of them were university students who were hooking on the side to pay tuition. When anti-prostitution feminists call out on behalf of women who are forced into prostitution, when they help prostitutes who have been damaged by that lifestyle and want to leave it, I applaud them and loudly. When they try either directly or indirectly to deny even one adult woman the right to use her body in any peaceful manner she sees fit, I strenuously object. A woman's body, a woman's right, is a slogan that applies not merely to abortion, but to every peaceful choice a woman can make with her body, from lesbianism to celibacy, from motherhood to whoring. And this is the moral dilemma that honest feminists like Kathleen Barry find themselves in. What do you do with the woman who chooses to enter sex work? With the strippers who love exploiting their bodies, who are exhibitionists, who love being up on the stage? What do you do with the student who wants to earn $300 an hour on the side rather than minimum wage as a secretary? What do you do with the women who look at sex work as exploiting the men, as controlling the sex act, and love it? I've talked to these women. You can tell me that they are lying to me. I look them in the eye. Anti-prostitution feminists either have to ignore the voices of dissenting women or to deny the truth of what is being said. In my experience, anti-prostitution feminists choose the latter course. They claim that whatever so-called liberated whores may say, they are actually forced into prostitution through psychological damage or economic coercion. Such feminists also make the additional claim of being pro-prostitute because they don't advocate going after the women, only the men involved. Now, I want to deal first of all with the claim that women never choose prostitution, that if the coercion is not apparent, it is still there psychologically or economically. First, let me address the idea of psychological coercion. The idea that women who claim to have, adult women who claim to, who persistently claim to have chosen this profession are brainwashed or stooges of the sex industry or victims of violence or whatever. Before doing so, however, I always need just to pause and actually consider one thing, how tremendously disrespectful this is of dissenting women. If a woman comes to you, an adult, articulate woman comes to you and says she chooses to strip, it is not because she is a different person with it, who's grown up with a different background, a different personality, a unique human being with different goals than you. No, it's because she is psychologically damaged and you are healthy. I ask you to consider for one moment how arrogant that is before moving on. She must be forced into making more acceptable choices, usually by criminalizing prostitution or sex work in some manner. Such criminalization is more than a denial of a woman's right to choose sex work. It is a denial of a woman's right to choose anything outside of a narrow, political, sexually correct corridor for women. Some anti-prostitution advocates strip women of their right to choose by referring to vague social impacts. Most simply choose to not acknowledge the voice of prostitutes or sex workers who dissent. Instead of crediting the abundant evidence that a substantial portion of prostitutes in North America, I'm specifically referring to our context here, consent, evidence including personal testimony, sex workers' rights organizations, contracts, witnesses, this is dismissed. One of my closest friends is Norma Jean Almodovar, author of From Crop to Call Girl, who worked as a call girl during most of our relationship, most of our friendship, and would still be doing so if her outspoken politics did not make her a target of the police. She's a bright, attractive woman with a marriage that's lasted over 20 years, and she gave up a good job as a police officer because, as she said it, she preferred making an honest living. This leads me into the subject of economic coercion. The idea that women under patriarchy or capitalism are so limited in their ability to make a living that this limitation forces them into prostitution. Clearly, women like Norma Jean were not under such a constraint. I can state that they were not economically coerced because I know something of economic necessity. When I was 16, I ran away from home and I lived on the streets. While on the street, I made certain choices. One of them was not become a sex worker. The fact is, and it's a fact with which I am intimately acquainted, that all choices are made in the presence of limited alternatives. This is an argument to increase the choices available to women. It is not an argument to limit even one option out there for a woman, including sex work. Some women who enter sex work will undoubtedly regret it, just as many women regret getting married. This is not a reason to ban marriage or prostitution. It is a reason to expand the choices available to women. Before moving on to whether eliminating prostitution, either directly or indirectly, is a pro-prostitute stance, I want to make something clear. I'm sure that many of you in the audience believe that the predominant feminist argument constitutes the feminist line on sex work, when actually it is merely the currently dominant position within the feminist movement, and a rather recently dominant position. Let me give you some fairly recent history. The prostitutes' rights movement first appeared through the organization known as COYOTE, an acronym for Call Off Your Old Tired Ethics. In early 1973, COYOTE emerged in San Francisco from a preceding group which was named WHO, Whores, Housewives, and Others. The others referred to were lesbians, a word no one even whispered at that juncture in time. And the willingness of prostitutes to embrace the cause of lesbian rights was one of their early and strongest links with many feminists of that time. Prostitutes stood up for the sexual rights of other women. They were more accessible than lesbians, and they stood up defending lesbians. The founder of COYOTE, Margot St. James, became convinced that a prostitute-based group was necessary because the feminist movement would not take seriously the rights of prostitutes until whores themselves stood up and said, we have a right to make a sexual choice. And the feminist movement responded with applause. In 1973, for example, now endorsed the decriminalization of prostitution. Ms. Magazine almost eulogized Margot St. James and described her, quote, drawing power, her genuine liking for people, coupled with a shrewd exploitation of herself. Her conversation is humorously profane, full of body puns and frank revelations about her sexual tastes, all intermingled with serious rhetoric about her mission to change the laws and image of prostitution, end quote. And remember, Ms. James' mission was to decriminalize prostitution and to remove the social stigma attached to it. As late as 1979, that'd be very early, prostitutes and mainstream feminists were actively and productively cooperating. For example, Coyote aligned with NOW in what was called a kiss-and-tell campaign to further the Equal Rights Amendment. A 1979 issue of Coyote Howls, the organization newsletter, declared, quote, Coyote has called on all prostitutes to join the international kiss-and-tell campaign to convince legislators that it is in their best interest to support issues of importance to women. The organizers of the campaign are urging that the names of legislators who have consistently voted against those issues, yet who are regular patrons of prostitutes, be turned over to feminist organizations for their use. End quote. In the mid-80s, the prostitutes' rights movement began to decline for several reasons. Two of the prominent ones, perhaps the two most prominent ones, are the political climate created by the AIDS epidemic and the rise of the radical feminist ideology that largely replaced the far more tolerant liberal feminist ideology. In 1985, Margot St. James left the United States to live in France. She cited the sexually conservative swing in American feminism as her motive in leaving. She's since returned. My point here is that dismissing the voice of liberated whores, saying that they themselves do not know what it means to be sexually liberated, they cannot define it for themselves. Their definition is invalid, and like a double-punch ballot, should be thrown out. This is not the feminist position on prostitution. It is a fairly recent development in feminist history. And even now, there is immense disagreement within feminism on this issue. Now, as a way of getting to what to me is a strange idea that it is somehow pro-prostitute or pro-woman's freedom to eliminate an unacceptable choice from society for women, I wanted to find two more terms. One is legalization, the other is decriminalization. Legalization refers to some form of state control, in terms of prostitution at least, state-controlled prostitution, for example, the creation of red light districts, or the Nevada-type brothel system. It always includes a government record of who is a prostitute, information that is commonly used in other contexts against the prostitute. For example, in Europe, many countries stamp a woman's passport in a manner to indicate she's a prostitute, and other countries routinely deny her entry because of that. Decriminalization is the opposite of legalization. It refers to the elimination of all laws against prostitution, including laws against those who associate with whores, that is, madams, pimps, and johns. This is what the prostitutes' rights movement calls for, the decriminalization of all aspects of prostitution. You will sometimes hear anti-prostitution feminists describe their position as decriminalization with the goal of abolition. But by the term decriminalization, each side means something very different. Prostitute activists mean that all aspects of prostitution must be legally tolerated, the men and the women. Anti-prostitution feminists mean that the police should not arrest the prostitutes, but only the men, the pimps and the johns, or the women who act like men, the madams. This is the reasoning, for example, behind the School for Johns, a phenomenon that began in San Francisco when anti-prostitution feminists teamed up with the Vice Department to formulate new policy on prostitution. By the way, the San Francisco Police Department is particularly hated by a sex rights organization because they have a tremendous record of huge brutality toward prostitutes and sex workers. I think they're the worst department in the United States. With the School for Johns, police arrested the customers and gave their first-time Johns an option. They could erase the rest from their records by paying a fee and by attending a one-day seminar during which they would be lectured to on the turpitude of their ways. Some cities like Chicago added the touch of publishing the names and addresses of men so arrested in major newspapers. Prostitute rights activists hate this development. For one thing, it has made the streets less safe for prostitutes. Historically speaking, laws against prostitution have never driven women out of the business, especially out of street walking, which is the lowest rung of prostitution, comprising something like 5 to 15% of prostitution, and where you will find all the problems that are identified as prostitution problems, drug addiction, violence, police abuse. That is where it's located. It's on the street walking level, and to a very large degree, not above that. So you have as many women as ever on the streets, with fewer men as customers, because the customers are discouraged by the laws. The customers who are no problem, the men who want to basically pay money and have a sex act, are also usually married with respectable careers. They have reputations to protect in society. They won't risk being publicly exposed as a John. On the other hand, men who are criminally inclined toward prostitutes will not be discouraged by the prospect of a police fine and attending a lecture. Thus, the School for Johns, a combination police-feminist endeavor, has kept peaceful Johns off the streets and left as many women to commit more vigorously and screen less rigorously for the men who still approach them. Whatever you think of street prostitution, whatever you think morally, is it good or bad? This is a policy that the prostitutes' rights movement say has directly led to the sharp increase of murder and violence against women on the streets with streetwalkers in North American cities. To the women who choose prostitution, arresting the men from whom they would make a living is a direct attack upon them, and you cannot code it as protection. It is ridiculous to state otherwise. It is comparable to saying that it is legal for a woman to practice law, but anyone who goes to her for a consultation or rents her office space will be arrested. No woman lawyer would believe that this is not an attack upon her right to practice law. And in focusing on arresting the men, as the solution usually offered to prostitution, in focusing on this area, let me once again defend the most extreme case, in the belief that this defense provides a defense of all lesser incidences, namely the pimp, the man who profits from a woman's prostitution. First, let me state again that I have no tolerance for men who abuse women. I dare say that by the time I was 16 and ran away from home, I experienced more violence in my life than most women in this room will ever incur in their whole lives. But the anti-pimping laws, as they are interpreted and enforced by the police, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about what do the women actually deal with in their daily life, not some ideal political situation, some law we pass in Congress and we all feel better. How does it affect the women on the street, the women in the brothels, the women in the strip clubs? It has nothing to do, the anti-pimping laws, with preventing violence against women. The definition of a pimp is an economic one. As one prostitute commented, quote, "In simple legal terms, a pimp is someone who lives off the earnings of a prostitute. Such a broad definition can include many people. Most of us don't think of when we hear that word. Children live off the earnings of a prostitute. Mothers, husbands, lovers, siblings, perhaps even parents, can all meet the basic requirements of being classified as pimps by the courts," end quote. Such laws do not punish people for beating, raping, or stealing from a whore. They do not define a pimp as a man who kidnaps a woman or coerces her onto the streets. Such laws refer to financial arrangements and target those who receive money or give money to whores. And so it becomes illegal for a sex worker to form the economic associations that most women take for granted. Anti-pimping laws also act as barriers to those prostitutes who wish to marry and get out of the business in that manner. A husband, even of an ex-whore, becomes automatically vulnerable to the charges of pimping. This is not an academic point. I have talked to many prostitutes who have basically been forced into giving information to the police because they have threatened their husbands with arrest. This is true of husbands who do not even primarily live off their wives' whoring, but who share expenses with them. But what if husbands, okay, let's take the worst-case scenario again, because that's how I'm fond of arguing. If I prove that or defend that, all lesser cases certainly seem to be colored by it. What if husbands or lovers who are fully dependent on the profits of prostitution, are they not parasites living off the backs of women? Well, maybe so. But whores are quick to point out that other women have the right to support their husbands and lovers. No one passes laws forbidding waitresses, lawyers, feminists, or secretaries from having dependent men in their lives. Why are whores the only women legally singled out in this manner? In her book, Female Sexual Slavery, which I've read and I respect greatly, Ms. Barry explains why pimps are particularly targeted by feminists. Quote, "Together, pimping and procuring are perhaps the most ruthless displays of male power and sexual dominance. Procuring is a strategy, a tactic for acquiring women and turning them into prostitution. Pimping keeps them there. Procuring today involves convincing a woman to be a prostitute through cunning, fraud, and or physical force, taking her against her will or knowledge and putting her into prostitution," end quote. How can this image of the pimp be reconciled with the following observation of a whore of my acquaintance, who wrote to me, quote, "Many of the men who get described as pimps are boyfriends, lovers, license plate number takers," and ask me a question and answer why that's significant if you want, "and managers. Many girls seek out pimps and even love their man. A girl has a right, even if she is a bit dumb, as being taken. And the venom of the law is another way to get at prostitutes, by busting their lovers. If a bank teller's husband beats her, he is charged with assault, not with being a bank teller's husband." End quote. The best explanation of the schism between these two portrayals of the pimp is that pimping, like every single aspect of prostitution, is not a monolith. It is not one institution. It is a very complex phenomenon that has existed through time and history and cannot be captured by one particular principle that we try to politically impose like a grid upon women's reality. Some pimps are husbands and friends who offer protection and friendship, but especially on the street level of prostitution, which is usually considered to be the only form of prostitution we deal with as the model, especially on that level, other pimps are kidnappers, batterers, and rapists who deserve to be taken out to an alley where feminism can be explained to them. But such criminals are not the ones being prosecuted by the law and the court system, any more than it is the violent John that is being arrested on the street. Over and over again, you hear of street prostitutes who have been raped and kidnapped by pimps. Ms. Barry in Female Sexual Slavery speaks of talking to several, a prostitute being raped and kidnapped, one who'd be sliced by a razor. They don't go to the police. In fact, Kathleen mentioned in her book saying that these women didn't consider reporting to the police. It is because the law routinely ignores such assaults against whores. Even worse, prostitutes are persecuted and physically abused by the police and by the legal system that protects other women. When you talk to prostitutes and sex workers, one of the things you immediately perceive is they know that the court system and the police system in our society are just two more forms, two more levels and layers of abuse of women. Unfortunately, I wish I did not have to say it, some of the voices within feminism themselves are becoming abuse of sex workers. Now, into which category I don't put Kathleen. The foregoing is a political analysis of the deepening schism between prostitute activists and anti-prostitution feminism. They should be natural allies. A woman's body, a woman's right, a woman's choice, these are the most marginalized women in our society. That we should be natural allies. We are becoming intractable enemies. I want to dramatize the damage being done by reading a poem that was written by my friend Norma Jean, and has specific history. In her capacity as one of the organizers of the 1997 International Congress on Prostitution, which is a strange story, Norma Jean coordinated an exhibition of horror art on a university campus. One of the most distressing encounters she experienced was with a politically correct feminist academic who insisted that prostitutes could not use the term whore to describe themselves, because apparently by doing so, these women did not understand that they were buying into their own oppression. They didn't have the right to label themselves as they so chose, because they were that politically unaware. Norma Jean wrote the poem to explain why the encounter made her finally embrace the word that had been used as a dagger against her, the word whore. It also captures what I believe is the emotional distress that many feminists are inflicting upon the most marginalized and the weakest faction of women in our society. It's called the whore word. I am a woman, and if I get out of line, you call me a whore. And if I have a good time, you call me a whore. And if I speak my mind, you call me a whore. You throw the word at me when I stand on my own. You use the word often to hold me down. You ever remind me that whores are the worst, the outcast pariahs without any worth. You're just a whore, you repeat like a mantra, like a shot of cold water to dampen my joy. You're just a whore, so what do you know? And what do I care of whatever you think? You're a whore is a dagger you drive through my heart as you pound into my psyche that name. You equate everything that I thought good with that word that you spit out like venom to show how awful I am. But I ask you, please tell me, just what is a whore? A whore says what she thinks, and she thinks for herself. She's independent and feisty. So what? Is there more? Why does it frighten you so to know I've a mind of my own and don't need your permission to live or to love or to be? And what if I tell you I don't care anymore? If you call me a whore, what will you call me now? I call the woman who wrote this poem a human being, an adult, who has the same right to make any peaceful choice with her body as any other woman, from marriage to celibacy, from abortion to divorce, from lesbianism to sex work. A woman's body, a woman's right, a woman's choice. Thank you.